places, everyone.
We're now broadcasting.
Roll the tape in. 3, 2.
A new audio drama.
Appaloosa Radio is where stories come alive.
Celeste. An Appaloosa Radio original story. When things were going well, when the computer code poured itself freely into its allocated slots, when the iterations, runs and routines worked to perfection, when all the bugs and jinks had been banished, that's when he took off his shoes, his socks and his shirt and wrote Code au Naturel. He told his colleague and lifelong friend, Mike, that when his feet felt the reality of the surfaces of the floor, it stimulated the neurons in his brain, made things clearer, opened options that he had not seen before. In the early 1980s, computer programming was still an activity of wide shirts, snap-on ties, and pocket protectors full of a miscellany of pens. That was not Rick. It may have been him once, back when he worked in the Department of Defense, running massive IBM behemoths, but it certainly was not him now. Now, he was running his own operation, creating computer schools for kids. The best idea that he ever had. Creating computer schools for kids. The market was unlimited. The work was straightforward. Taking computer lessons from a book that he had written to a computer-assisted teaching design. Simple code. Nothing that complex. Yet, there were only the two of them, and the project had its own obstacles. Last night at 3 a.m., Rick had a mental breakthrough. He knew how to solve a problem that had been plaguing them for weeks. He woke Mike at an ungodly hour, and they drove to the office, grabbing breakfast sandwiches and coffee on the way. For Rick, it was a monumental day of coding. For Mike, the work was arduous, and since they did not stop for lunch fatigue. At 8:45 in the evening, Rick decided to turn off the systems. He pulled on his socks and his custom cowboy boots, which had been made for him during a trip to Spain. He buttoned his blue-gray silk shirt that he had found in Milan. And, in spite of the muggy, South Carolina heat, he put on his black leather jacket, the one he had discovered in Montreal. He walked down the open stairwell, then across the parking lot, and over a couple of short blocks to the Ramada Inn Hotel, where a live band was playing in the lounge. The Friday night customers were filling all the small round tables around the parquet dance floor. A lot more action than three nights earlier. This time he had drug along his working partner, Mike. Mike was grumpy. He had been coding all day and his brain was spent. His grumpiness was made all the worse since learning the small startup that he had been working for had unexpectedly ceased all operations. That was Mike's fallback job. He had bills to pay, a family to support back in Cincinnati. He had taken a leave of absence because this looked like such a sure thing. The best idea that his best friend ever had. Creating computer schools for kids. The market was unlimited. The work was straightforward. Taking computer lessons from a book to a computer-assisted teaching design. Simple code. Nothing that complex. Still, the work was unpaid, and this was August. They had been working on the project since May. A couple more months if all goes well. And Disney was interested in the project. Interested enough that they had advanced $250,000. However, interested in does not mean purchasing. Before anything could be sold, they still had mountains to climb. Mountains that appeared all the taller because the original cash advance was now nearly depleted. He brought Mike into the lounge, sat him at a round table, and ordered him a drink, which he nursed. A dour presence in what was otherwise a very alive place. In the 1980s, South Carolina still required cocktails to be served without alcohol. Customers were handed a small bottle from which they added their own. Mike dumped the whole bottle into his seltzer drink. Scotch and soda is not worth much without the scotch. With Mike appeased with a drink, he appraised the crowd that had gathered at the Ramada Lounge. There was a rotund salesman showing off what he believed were his Las Vegas dance moves. There was a middle-aged couple celebrating what was probably an anniversary. He wore his best business suit, complete with a Belk's department store tie, well knotted into a Windsor. She wore a Kelly evening dress that revealed nothing. Only her jewelry showed her status. Long strings of real pearls and diamonds on nearly every finger. They danced a couple of slow dances and then settled at one of the round tables with their cocktails. They'll be home in their pajamas by 9:30, he thought. His attention was drawn to one woman. She had pure white hair, straightened, and styled into a page boy. An interesting and very sophisticated look for Spartanburg. Her black leather miniskirt topped her black fishnet stockings, and a neon pink blouse exposed ample cleavage. She danced with energy and skill. Her dance moves were genuinely of Las Vegas quality. professional level, to be more precise. Of course, the rotund salesman asked her to dance, but in the middle of their dance, a tall, bearded local guy cut in. The local guy told her that he owned a trucking company, and he would enjoy buying her a drink. She said no to the drink but suggested that they keep dancing. "I like your moves," she flirted. Finally, after another 15 minutes or so, she told him, "I'll take that drink now." The tall, local guy joined her and her friend at one of the round tables. Her friend was younger. Pretty, but just a few pounds over her ideal. She was wearing a frilly white dress that revealed nothing. It was the kind of dress that Southern women would wear to their favorite niece's high school graduation. Indeed, that is exactly why it had been purchased 2 years earlier. The family had gone to Atlanta for a graduation. He watched the tall, local guy quickly chug his drink and then ask the woman in the leather miniskirt to dance again. He was impatient to get at it. This time, his hands actively explored every feature the woman had to offer. No hesitation. No reservation. Not much to do with the music from the band. Simple male aggression. She allowed it. To a point. Then, she would dance away, and he would be grasping only air. The tall local guy may have believed that he was the predator, but on this parquet dance floor, the prey controlled the situation. Pointing with him, playing. Just out of reach. Close, but not too close.
"Not tonight, Bubba."
While the performance was continuing on the dance floor, the computer guy left his friend Mike and walked over to where the young woman in the white dress was sitting. He noticed that she was extremely pretty. Dark eyes and dark hair. Tall and probably athletic. He guessed that she wore glasses, but had taken them off when she came into the Ramada Inn lounge. "Hello, pretty lady. Would you object if I join you for a while? I was noticing that your friend left you alone. Thought you might enjoy some company."
"She's not my friend. She is my aunt. Up from Atlanta. She is up here for her business."
"Oh, what kind of business?"
"Her company makes scented note cards that they sell in gift shops."
"Scented note cards. Is there much of a market for that?"
"Must be. She told me that last year she sold over $1 million worth of cards."
"So, she is a sales representative."
"Well, sort of. She also owns the company."
"Nice to have an aunt who does so well in her commercial enterprise."
"She has always been my favorite."
"Can I ask a favor of you? Can we move outside and continue our conversation? I don't want to go far, just beyond those double doors to the pool area. I had polio as a child, and it affected my lung capacity. I am especially susceptible to cigarette smoke. It is getting pretty thick in here. I would appreciate it if we could talk outside where there is less smoke."
"Sure, no problem."
He opened the doors, and they walked outside. He leaned against one of the brick pillars holding up sections of the wrought iron fence. He maintained a gentlemanly and respectful distance. "Much better. Easier to breathe." He continued to talk. "I am Richard Hume Harden. Two last names. My grandparents only had girls, so their name died with them. After high school, I decided to officially change my name to honor them. I also thought it would give me an aura of sophistication." He paused to watch her. Then he continued. "When I was in the army, that's when having two names gave me a real problem. None of their forms could handle it." She smiled. He asked, "And pretty lady with the beautiful dark eyes, what is your name?"
"I am Celeste. Celeste Raider."
Pleased to meet you, Miss Celeste Rader.
Really sorry, but it is Mrs. Rader.
Well, I am pleased to meet you, Mrs. Rader.
I am going through a divorce. I have filed papers, but he has gotten really ugly.
But I know about ugly divorces. I have been through one myself. Especially hard when there are kids involved.
Did you beat your wife, Mr. Richard Hume Harden?
No, never.
Good. We can be friends.
Maybe even close friends.
Yes, maybe even very close friends.
Call me Rick. What do you want me to call you?
I am Celeste. Just Celeste. Only one name.
Well, Celeste, with only one name. I need your phone number if I am going to call you.
I would like that. Very much.
The computer project that had brought Rick and Mike to South Carolina was facing a major uphill climb and, unfortunately, funds were beginning to run low. The original investment by Disney had seemed incredible. Now, in late August, it seemed woefully insufficient. The most pressing problem was one inherent to the project itself. Dr. Richard Hume Harden, yes, doctor, had originally written a series of computer lessons for a federal grant that he had obtained for his North Carolina Public University. Lessons that the university offered free in various summer camps for underserved, urban kids. Rick had decided to turn these lessons into a commercial product that he could sell. However, if he developed a commercial product in North Carolina, he would be open to a conflict of interest claim. So, he moved the project to South Carolina and applied for his sabbatical leave from the university. Getting the Disney Corporation as an investor was a welcome support. Bringing in his high school friend was another. Creating lessons that paralleled his original grant was the easy part. Getting them to work was harder. Here is the issue. Rick had originally written the lessons for an Apple IIe computer. The very first generation of the personal computer. The one Steve Jobs invented. Jobs and his partners had decided to create a computer that used commercial television sets to display its graphics. Go to any store. Buy a portable TV set and then wire it to the computer. Disney, on the other hand, ran on another system. One manufactured by the Digital Equipment Corporation, DEC. Every payroll function, every banking function, every inventory control function, all ran on deck computers. And, at their amusement parks, every ride and every attraction ran on deck computers. Whenever the Bear Country Jamboree stuffed animals sang a song, whenever Mr. Lincoln spoke, or whenever the Wild Thunder Mountain roller coaster roared through its artificial desert landscape, everything was controlled by a deck computer system. Deck computers were great for handling numeric operations. They were fast, efficient, highly reliable. However, they were not designed to display graphics. Most of the monitors available for deck computers were originally designed for the military, especially for tasks like radar or sonar tracking systems. they were not designed for a 9-year-old to draw the house where the three bears lived. So, Disney wanted Rick and Mike's computer lessons to run on DEC computer systems. However, the graphics capability of DEC computers was not sufficient for the task. Rick and Mike had to do some very heavy programming at the machine system level. However, they did not have enough money to hire the kind of computer expert they needed for the work. It was late August. Mike's fallback job was now gone. The project was in difficulty. Rick's sabbatical leave from the university would end in December, and he was expected to have produced, published original research during it. Otherwise, his application for tenure would be in danger. Additionally, the company finances were getting tight. However, Rick was now spending almost every waking hour with Celeste. That is, Celeste, the woman now with only one name.
Charles Rader was the District 2 superintendent for the Spartanburg County Department of Bridges and Roads. Any and all road and bridge repairs in the northeast portion of the county were his responsibility. Charles had gotten his position because of his loyalty to Big Jack Boyce, the longtime county commissioner. In fact, both Big Jack and Charles Rader lived in Lake Bowen, just four houses apart. When in 1978, Big Jack Boyce switched from being an old school Southern Democrat to a new school Ronald Reagan Republican, Charles Rader smoothed things over for him with the boys. Big Jack knew that no South Carolina politician could remain in office without the support of the boys. And Big Jack was grateful to Charles for his help. Besides, no road in District 2 ever got built without the express permission of Big Jack. And the best way to get Big Jack's permission was with a donation, preferably in cash, to Big Jack's political fund. Charles Rader was responsible for ensuring that donations, in an appropriate amount, occurred before road repairs began. So, Charles Rader did not actually supervise any of the road or bridge repairs. No. That task was assigned to Charles' assistant superintendent, Joe Mears. Joe Mears was a hard man. The 54-year-old former Marine ran his various work crews with a barrage of constant profanity delivered from the driver's seat of his orange Spartanburg County pickup truck. He never left it. Nor was he ever without a wad. Profanity mixed with tobacco juice. He was a hard man. Profanity mixed with tobacco juice. He was, everyone knew, a hard man.
Celeste Lynn Lewis met Charles Rader at a summer church picnic hosted by the Boiling Springs Baptist Church. She was 15 and had just completed her sophomore year. She also had just gotten her learner's permit and now worked part-time at Hardee's Hamburgers. She was living at her grandmother's house, sharing a room with her younger sister Doreen. At one time, there really was a Boiling Springs geyser that reportedly shot streams of hot water 6 to 8 feet in the air, but by the early 1930s, it had largely fizzled out. Today, the former Boiling Springs are buried under the parking lot for a grocery store. Still, the name remains. Celeste Lynn, as she was known by her family, and her younger sister had come to Boiling Springs from North Carolina where their father had worked in the furniture industry. Unfortunately, he died in an automobile accident when Celeste Lynn was 12. Not long thereafter, Celeste's mother disappeared. She drove out of town and was never seen again. The police called Celeste's grandmother and asked her to drive north and pick the girls up. Celeste was smart, likable, and extremely pretty. She was also naive and unsure of herself. Charles Rader was 19 and had just returned from basic training with the South Carolina National Guard. His face was tanned, and his body muscled. He was also cocky and very sure of himself. He never actually took Celeste on a date. He did not yet have a job and he was not very interested in finding one. When they had hamburgers and Cokes, she paid for them. What Charles Rader was interested in was getting into this pretty girl as fast as he could. He was not romantic or caring. No sweet words of affection. No promises of enduring commitment. Just the animal will to overcome and the strength to make her do what he wanted. She continued to go out with him not because she loved him. In truth, she did not really like him. But he knew what he wanted, and was willing to do anything to get it. Her will did not match his. Because she was unsure, lacked confidence in herself. Celeste Lewis never said she was in love with Charles Mason Rader, and he certainly never said that he loved her. She was available, and he took it. She had no further value. He asked for it, and she gave it to him. And should not have been a surprise to them. 6 weeks after they met at the church picnic, Celeste Lynn Lewis told Charles Rader that she was pregnant. He called her stupid, then cunning witch, and finally a slut. Nonetheless, Charles Rader married Celeste. On their wedding night, he beat her hard. Just so she knew who was in charge. Got to teach her who is in charge. Got to teach her before she gets any ideas.
Mike remembered seeing Celeste at the Ramada. In lounge. He found her neither interesting nor attractive. In fact, she seemed very uncomfortable and out of place for the busy nightclub. It was a Friday night. Men and women came there to listen to the music, dance, make connections, drink some alcohol, make hits on each other, in the hope of getting more. Mike's own thought was that this was the place, and the night, where, and when, South Carolina came to sin. That was S-I-N. In all capitals. Spartanburg may have been the buckle of the Bible Belt, but it was still a place of fast-flowing, raging, volcanic sin. That first time that Mike saw Celeste at the lounge, she looked like a woman attending a ladies' afternoon tea with other ladies from the PTA. Frilly dress with puffy sleeves. Not what women typically wore when they were on the prowl at a nightclub. He was more than surprised that his friend Rick found her attractive. However, when, about a week later, she came by the office to bring them some lunch. Wow, what a difference. She had the shortest shorts and the skimpiest top. Her hair was long and dark, waved in massive curly cascades. In fact, had Mike not already known who she was, he would have taken her for the TV character Daisy Duke from that 1970s television show. And her Daisy Duke's jeans cut into shorts, were tightly fitted on a gorgeous, well-shaped body. A fantasy woman in every regard. In every regard. Unfortunately for the work that needed completion on their project, Rick left with her after eating his fried chicken and drinking his lemonade. He left the pie for Mike. "I'll get my dessert later," he whispered knowingly. Mike did not see him again until the next day, but Rick was in no condition to do serious computer coding. He said hello and then went into their outer office and fell asleep on one of the stuffed chairs they had rented for their business. Mike roused him at noon to get his advice on a technical problem that had been hindering their work. Rick went into the bathroom and treated himself to a sponge bath. Mike and Rick were about 10 minutes into a technical conversation when Celeste appeared again. This time she was wearing a swimsuit and had her three children in tow.
Remember, Rick, you promised to take us all to the lake. I hope you are ready.
Rick, Celeste, and three kids left for the afternoon. At about 3:30, Mike stopped doing all work. He walked over to the Ramada and lounge and ordered a double scotch and soda. In South Carolina, that meant getting two sodas and two small bottles of scotch. Double drinks were not allowed. What a place. Mike wanted to go home. Back to Cincinnati. Back to his family. Rick was his best friend. And this was the best idea that Rick ever had. And they were so close to finishing it. But, maybe, just maybe, it was time to give it up.
Charles and Celeste lived on a one-acre parcel in the community of Lake Bowen. They lived in the community, but not actually on the lake. Of course, Charles' boss Big Jack Boyce had a massive house with his own private dock right on the lake. Charles told everyone that he lived four houses from Big Jack. What he did not say was that most folks would want to drive their car from the Raider's house to Big Jack's. The houses between the two were on supersized lots, and the golf course cut between them. In actual distance, it was probably 3/4 of a mile between the two. So, Charles lived in a nice house, but not an opulent one. Behind the main house, Charles had moved in a manufactured home for his mother. Meemaw was often the babysitter for the three Raider children. Especially when Celeste was working at her job as a secretary at the neighborhood elementary school. Big Jack had gotten her the job when Charles had complained about not having enough income. Celeste never knew where Charles' salary went. She did know that without her income, things would be very tough for them. They found that out for certain when, last May, Celeste had to go to the hospital for an emergency miscarriage. They could not stop the bleeding and she nearly died. The family found out that despite Charles' substantial income, he did not have enough money to feed his wife and his children. Meemaw had to contribute money from her own savings to keep things going.
The court order that Celeste had obtained when she filed for divorce prohibited Mr. Charles M. Raider from entering the property located on South Lake Bowen Drive. However, no stupid court order could stop him from coming onto a property which he owned. It was called property rights, after all. Celeste had become hysterical, and, like always, was behaving stupid. She was as dumb as a cow. After her time in the hospital, she became afraid of everything. Scaredy cat. Stupid. Maybe divorce was the best thing. Get rid of her and find a woman who really loved him. The problem was that in a divorce, she would get half of everything. Half of everything.
She came home from what had been the most perfect day of her life. They had hiked to the waterfalls north of Asheville on the Blue Ridge Parkway and had enjoyed a secluded picnic and some intense lovemaking. Perfect day with her perfect person. She came home to find Charles sitting in the dark, in their living room. The kids had gone with Mima to the Christian amusement park just outside Charlotte. They would not be home until tomorrow. Charles, you're not allowed to be here.
I'm allowed to be wherever I want to be. No stupid court can stop that.
What do you want?
I have a simple message for your new Yankee boyfriend, the university professor and his computers. Tell him to watch out. Better watch out.
What does that mean?
It means just what I said it means. You are one stupid bitch. I don't know why I ever married you.
Charles, you had better go. Or, I'll call the police.
The sheriff? He is a friend of mine. We play golf every other Thursday.
He looked ready to hit her but decided against it. He picked up his car keys, made a growling sound, and then left. Celeste went into the bathroom. She was violently shaking, and she could not stop.
Joe Mears was a hard man. He was a profane man who knew what had to be done and how to make it happen. Ask Joe to do it and it was done. Simple. He had been hardened by the Marines. They had given him a medal for killing communists in Korea. Hell, he would have killed more of them if they had let him. He seldom left the cab of his Orange County work truck. To pee. To eat. To kick someone's behind. Then back in, driving like the demon menace he really was. He was a hard man. Did what he was told. Never complained. Never tattled. Never failed. He drove his county truck north on Highway 221. Just across the North Carolina state line, he parked in a thicket with a line of visibility to the highway. It was an hour before dusk. Always a good time for hunting prey.
This is a WSBA Channel 7 news break. The McDowell County Sheriff's Office has reported to the Channel 7 news team that they have discovered a man murdered, sitting in his car, just yards north of the state line on Highway 221. They believe that the murder may have occurred in South Carolina and the man's vehicle continued its progress into North Carolina where it finally ran into a drainage ditch. According to the police officials, the man was shot multiple times from short range with what they believe was a shotgun. The McDowell County officials identified the murder victim as Richard Holmes Hardin, a university professor from North Carolina. The officials have learned that the victim was in South Carolina working on a computer project. South Carolina law enforcement authorities are cooperating with North Carolina officials in this investigation. Anyone with information about this crime should contact the Channel 7 Crime Stoppers Network at the number now on the screen.
Mrs. Celeste Rader spoke at length with the detectives assigned to the case. She was convinced that her husband Charles Rader had orchestrated the murder. However, the North Carolina detectives were not sure whether to trust her testimony. She seemed flighty and nervous. They did interview her husband, Mr. Charles Rader, and determined that at the time of the murder, he was in Columbia, South Carolina, attending a mandatory meeting of the road and bridge supervisors from all the jurisdictions in the state. Citizen concern had developed over the safety of the state's many bridges and all bridges were to be subject to immediate inspection. Charles Rader had even been interviewed during the meeting by reporters from the South Carolina Public Television Network. So, the detectives from North Carolina determined that Mr. Charles Rader was not a suspect in the murder.
Rick's murder ended the enterprise. He closed the offices and paid as many of the bills as he could. Then, he filed for corporate bankruptcy. Rick had been his best friend, and this was the best idea that Rick ever had. They were so close to finishing it. So close. So close. They had even solved what they believed was their biggest obstacle, getting DEC computers to generate high-quality graphics. Before he began his drive back north to Cincinnati, Mike stopped in the Ramada Inn Hotel Lounge and ordered a double scotch and soda. He put the two small bottles in his pocket and quickly chugged the seltzer water. He kept the sealed bottles in a drawer, never drinking them. Sort of a souvenir for what might have been.
Appaloosa Springs Audio Theater is a creative collaboration whose purpose is to write, produce, and share original story content through webcast radio experiences.